Locked and Loaded, today on The World. President Trump's rhetoric on North Korea heats up. He says the U.S. military is locked and loaded should Pyongyang act unwisely. You'd think people in South Korea would be worried, but...
Among civilians, I'm getting the sense that there is no real tangible worry.
Plus, a smartphone app that helps blind people experience the upcoming solar eclipse.
People will discover, I can also hear this, and I can also touch it.
And a 14-year-old South African girl who will not let HIV win.
I'm still very much alive. Most born with this virus die much earlier. I am grateful for the life I still have. God, you know this.
That's all coming up today on this edition of The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. It is Friday, and we've been focused a lot this week on the war of words between President Trump and the regime in North Korea, words that have escalated tensions across the globe. We'll get back to that in a few minutes, but right now, let's pause the rhetoric and start with something else I think is worthy of global attention. The total solar eclipse coming up on August 21st. It will be spectacular. I guarantee it.
Watch it, watch it, watch it.
Oh, my God. That, oh, my God, was me back in 2006 watching a total solar eclipse in the Libyan desert. Unforgettable experience. And 10 days from now, millions of people will have the chance to experience something similar as the moon's shadow floats across the U.S. ever so perfectly from northwest to southeast. Eclipse chasers from all over the globe will gather along the so-called path of totality to see for themselves. There's one group of people, though, that feels left out of this event, the blind. The World's Carolyn Beeler has a story about one man trying to change that.
It sounds kind of like the beginning of a joke. How can someone who can't see experience an eclipse?
She asked me to describe what an eclipse is like, and I was caught completely flat-footed.
This is astrophysicist Trey Winter, who got this question from someone at a conference several months ago. So he told her how crickets can start chirping in the middle of the day during eclipses.
The reaction that she had was powerful, and I wanted to replicate that sense of awe and wonder to as many people as I could across the country.
So he set out to make something to help people hear and feel the upcoming eclipse.
So can we get out the app and have you...
In a conference room at the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics in Cambridge, Winter pulls an iPad out of his messenger bag to show me his Eclipse Soundscapes app. He showed me its coolest feature.
Rumble map. Selected. Press to interact with Rumble map.
So, here we have an image of the eclipse.
There's a pitch black moon surrounded by faint sunlight. Brighter spots that astronomers call Bailey's beads shoot out on one side.
These are little shards of sunlight peeking around the moon. And as I touch the different features on the sun, you can hear the sound changing. And what we've done is we've interpreted this visual information, variations in light and dark and color, into sonic information.
The idea is to translate eclipse images into sound. Dark areas are quiet when you touch them.
And now I'm moving towards the Bailey's beads, so towards a brighter area. You can hear the intensity and the frequency changing. And now I'm going to hit the beads, which are these bright areas on the sun, and you'll hear a very dramatic change. Hear that?
The app also makes your phone or tablet vibrate faster and faster for brighter spots in the eclipse photos.
We managed to create frequencies that resonate with the body of the phone.
Audio engineer Miles Gordon worked on the app.
And so the phone is vibrating entirely using the speaker.
There are other tools for blind people to experience eclipses, like tactile maps and books, but Winter wanted to make something more interactive. Still, the blind colleague who first asked Winter about eclipses was skeptical of the idea.
The first time I heard that blind people were being asked to pay attention to the eclipse, I kind of laughed to myself and tried to contain my really dismissive reaction. It almost sounds like a joke.
This is Chancey Fleet, an accessible technology educator at a library in New York. She's trained to think beyond visuals, but says she still thought eclipses just weren't a thing for blind people.
But once again, nothing is ever just visual, really. And this just proves that same point again. I'm looking forward to experiencing it for myself and not just hearing or reading about it.
Fleet wasn't involved with developing the app, but astronomer Wanda Diaz-Merced was.
People will discover, oh, I can also hear this, and I can also touch it, see?
Diaz-Merced is also blind. She built her own computer program to turn visual data from telescopes into sound when she went blind in her late 20s. She hopes the app will get more kids who are blind interested in science.
So that is very, very, very important.
The app goes live today, but it's not the end of the team's project. Phase two is to crowdsource audio recordings of how people and wildlife react to this month's eclipse. The sound will go into a special database that's accessible to the blind. And that is the part of the project Diaz-Merced is most excited about.
What I do hope is that databases in science will use the model that Trey is using for us to have meaningful access to the information. And that perhaps through Trey's database, we will not be segregated.
That way, she hopes the legacy of Trey Winter's project to help blind people experience the eclipse lasts far beyond this summer. For The World, Carolyn Beeler, Cambridge, Massachusetts.
We'll be hearing a lot more about the eclipse in the days ahead. You can bet on that. And we want you and your eclipse experiences to be part of our coverage. Maybe you're road tripping to be in the path of totality on August 21st, or climbing to the top of a mountain to see it with your kids, or maybe getting out of your town to avoid all the umbrophile tourists. Tell us your eclipse plans, and we may put you on the radio, unless, of course, you'd prefer to stay dark. See what I did there? Anyway, call and leave us a voicemail at 877-406-6303. That's 877-406-6303. Or send a voice memo to eclipse@pri.org. Okay, if you are planning to watch the eclipse, some caution is in order, because looking at the sun during an eclipse can cause serious, often permanent damage to your eyes, except during the couple of minutes of totality. So think ahead and wear eclipse glasses. Ari Daniel, with our WGBH partners at NOVA, is here to explain. This may be an obvious question, Ari, but why is it dangerous to look at the sun directly, even during an eclipse?
Sunlight is incredibly intense, Marco. So if you look directly at the sun, that intense light can overwhelm the photoreceptors at the back of your eye and cause them to start to break down. And so they begin to release these nasty chemicals that can actually attack the cell itself. And beyond that, some of that sunlight can even scorch the cells behind the retina.
So what kind of damage can actually happen to your eyes? And is there any chance of recovery when this happens?
Even briefly looking at the sun can cause some damage, and because that damage doesn't show up for some number of hours afterwards, it's hard to say exactly how damaged it is immediately after looking at the sun. What I can say is that sometimes the cells will repair themselves if the damage isn't severe enough, but if it's too intense and too much sunlight, then it can lead to scarring, death of the cells, and even a blind spot on the back of the eye. So the damage can be permanent to the part of the eye that sees color and detail. In fact, I spoke with a retired professor of optometry at the University of Waterloo named Ralph Chu, who told me about a patient of his who actually had crescent-shaped burns on the back of his retina.
He stared at the sun many times during the course of a partial eclipse, and he ended up with multiple burns at the back of the eye. And so, you know, he had a spot right in the center of his vision where the photoreceptors are at their highest density, and it was damaged. And then around it, we had this whole constellation of retinal burns. And as a clinician, it was interesting to look at, but, you know, the visual consequences were that he was legally blind.
So legally blind, I'm assuming eclipse glasses would avoid this. How do they actually work?
Eclipse glasses are a physical block for the sunlight that comes to your eye. Sunglasses are not enough. They block 60 to 85% of the light coming through. glacier glasses, which you might wear if you're going to go out in kind of a wintry landscape.
Right, extreme mountaineering. So.
Exactly, are not enough. They block 99% of the light. Eclipse glasses block 99.9996% of the light coming through. And you need to make sure that the eclipse glasses meet a certain standard. Somewhere on the eclipse glasses, it should say that it meets the ISO 12312-2 standard.
So where can you find eclipse glasses, Ari? Because I know a few people, especially now, trying to find them. They seem to be sold out everywhere.
There's been a rush on eclipse glasses. A lot of places have been giving them out. You might still be able to find them at science museums or planetariums. If you go to a place where there are a lot of people gathered, I would imagine that there are going to be the right kinds of filters for looking at the sun, or you might be able to borrow someone else's eclipse glasses.
And just remind us when it is safe to look at the eclipse coming up on August 21st.
The only time it's safe to look at the sun is when the moon is completely covering the face of the sun. And the only thing that's visible is the outer corona, the solar atmosphere. So that's two-ish minutes. It's only when it completely covers it that you can take your eclipse glasses off and look at that place in the sky where the sun ought to be.
What are your plans to watch the eclipse, Ari?
I'm heading up to Cascade, Idaho, which is a little bit north of Boise. Mm-hmm. And so I'll be talking with you that day, Marco, about what it's like to be up there and working on a video for NOVA as well. What I've heard is kind of west of the Mississippi seems to be good viewing.
Well, best of luck with that trip, Ari. Thanks very much.
It's my pleasure, Marco.
Ari Daniel there with our partners at NOVA. You can watch NOVA's video about what eclipses can do to your eyes on our Facebook page. Just search for PRI The World. And don't forget to tune in August 21st on PBS to watch NOVA's feature about the eclipse. Okay, I said earlier that we'd put the North Korea news on pause, but we can't ignore it, not when President Trump started the day today tweeting this: military solutions are now fully in place, locked and loaded should North Korea act unwisely. So let's find out what people are thinking in South Korea as they head into the weekend.
Among civilians, I'm getting the sense that there is no real tangible worry.
That's reporter Kate Kasula. She's based in Seoul.
I've spoken to a number of people today as well as over the last month. And the answer that I constantly keep getting is that even if there is this feeling of constant worry in South Korea, it's one that you don't really feel because this conflict has been going on for almost 70 years now. And so it really does kind of feel like business as usual when there is an exchange between major world leaders that's pretty hostile.
Is there a sense, though, that Trump's rhetoric and approach does threaten a diplomatic relationship with South Korea?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, every single analyst or historian that I've spoken with in recent days is really concerned about the relationship between the United States and North Korea, but also the United States and South Korea and Japan. And part of the reason for that is when Trump makes a comment such as he will send fire and fury to North Korea, he's really treating South Korea and Japan as expendable, basically, right? Because if there were an actual conflict because of what he says, because of a fear of miscalculation, Seoul would really be the one to suffer those casualties. So it doesn't help the alliance. Also, the South Korean president is trying to engage with North Korea right now. So threats certainly don't help from South Korea's, you know, biggest ally.
Is there a sense that the lack of any official channel of communication between Washington and Pyongyang, that is a major problem in all of this?
Absolutely. And part of the problem is when Trump threatens North Korea like that, he's actually fueling its propaganda machine. I mean, the narrative that North Korea likes to give its people is that South Korea is a victim or a puppet of the United States. The U.S. is in imminent danger to North Korea at all times. And so essentially, in Trump's own words, he's confirming that for North Korean propaganda.
Kelly Kasulis in Seoul, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
Born with HIV but determined to live a full life, a young woman's story from South Africa, that's coming up on The World.
I Like Words.
A podcast.
Elegant, flowery words.
About language.
Tonsorial.
The world in words.
Grapple, jostle.
The world in words.
Crunchy, crackly words.
Get it on Apple Podcasts.
Or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're wrapping up a week of coverage from South Africa about the HIV epidemic there and its impact on young women. As you've been hearing, this is a huge challenge for South Africa. Young women there are twice as likely to become infected with HIV as young men. Our Across Women's Lives team has been reporting on why that's happening and on efforts to reverse the trend. Today, the world's Jasmine Garst has a story of one young woman and how she came to terms with being HIV positive.
It's a clear winter morning in Pretoria. On a suburban lawn, under the shade of a tree, a young man is pleading his case.
I'm not a child anymore. I've got ideas of my own now.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I've actually had them in my life as well. They always know what is best for you, don't they?
They're two actors rehearsing for an upcoming production of the play My Children, My Africa. 22-year-old Sadie Brown plays a character of Isabella. Brown is a young actress, but she's spent a lifetime performing. She started when she was a teenager. She was at a school event, and healthcare workers were doing free HIV testing. Sadie thought it would be fun.
So I went in there, and I had an HIV test, and
she tested positive. She was just 14. She was a virgin.
The first thing I asked her was how. Like, those are like the only words that kept on ringing in my mind, that how. I begged her to do another test.
This is when she started her big performance, her own. Act one, the girl who doesn't tell anyone.
So I just kept everything in, walked out, and just like continued with the whole happy persona that I am.
She went home, where she lived with her auntie. Sadie never said anything to anyone, but she thought about it all the time. She remembers sitting in health class.
It was just 8 kills. 8 kills. Be careful, or condomize, or do this and that. And for a 14-year-old, seeing those things, it still scared me that, okay, so when is my time coming?
South Africa was in the midst of the HIV epidemic that continues to this day. They confront it with education programs, warnings about the importance of using condoms, and calls for abstinence. But no one could be prepared for what came next, a generation of children born with the virus. And that's what Sadie found out had happened. About 6 months after her HIV test, she finally broke down and told her aunt. And her aunt's response shocked her.
I knew about your parents. I didn't know about you.
Her parents had died when she was around 9. First her dad, then her mom. It never crossed her mind that they might have died of AIDS-related diseases. She was just never told what they died of. Sadie says she was furious. She started piecing together all these childhood memories.
I always just think of that picture of my mom crying at my daddy's funeral, and I'm like, she actually knew. I literally felt betrayed by my parents, by God, by my aunt. Like, I felt betrayed by everyone.
She wrote a lot about those feelings. She reads me this letter that she penned, as if HIV were a person she could confront.
Because of you, I'm an orphan. Because of you, I'm all alone. All that is happening is just too much. I've tried so much to live by the book. I've tried so much to behave. My attempts of escaping you were in vain, as I have always had you. Because of you, life has spiraled out of control. I'm fully aware that I have no right questioning God's will, but he took the only two people I could question about all this.
For the next few years, Sadie just carried on, as if nothing had happened, until she turned 16. In August, in South Africa, it's windy and dusty. The winter nights can be cold. During the day, the sun burns. Sadie started to get sores around her body and her face. Her T-cell count, which is one indicator of the strength of an immune system, had plummeted.
It was like approximately 100.
A normal count is between 500 and 1500. Sadie was in trouble. Her HIV was advancing. She finally went to the clinic and started taking antiretrovirals to suppress the virus, which is the beginning of Act Two. The girl who has HIV tells everyone.
I'm still very much alive. Most babies born with this virus die much earlier
That just goes to show that I was born on this earth for a purpose, and not even two lines on an HIV testing material will bring me down. I am grateful for the life I still have. God, you know this.
She told her friends, and they rallied around her. In the next few years, she became what she calls an HIV victor, an outspoken activist. It isn't always this upbeat, living with the virus. Sadie says the thought of taking medication for the rest of her life is sometimes daunting. And so is dating. She's been rejected because of her HIV status and says it was devastating. But right now, she's in a relationship with a woman. She's really happy.
So, yeah, she knows about my status because I'm just that person. I'm just like, dude, I'm HIV positive.
Sadie needs to get back to her rehearsal. She's hitting the road soon, presenting this play in high schools throughout South Africa. She heads back to her sunny yard where her fellow actors are waiting for her to practice her monologue.
They were staring and listening so hard I could feel it on my skin. All of it had become one of the most realist experiences I have ever had. I have never before had so exciting a sense of myself. Because that is what we all want, isn't it? For things to be real. Our lives, our thoughts, what we say and do. That's what I want now.
For the World, Jasmine Garst, Pretoria, South Africa.
Wow, she's one powerful young woman. Jasmine's story is part of our Across Women's Lives coverage from South Africa. And later on the show today, one final story from our team there about an artist whose work is all about her experiences as a woman in South Africa. Here's a quick preview of a story we'll have for you on the show next week, the story of Wulfhart Kutz. You could say Kutz has lived two lives, one before the Berlin Wall came down and one after. While the wall was still in place, he was a citizen of the socialist utopia of East Germany, where he was spied on a lot. He knows that because soon after East Germany ceased to exist, Kutz was allowed to read his Stasi file.
I read that I have a tape recorder and a turntable and played a record.
The Stasi, of course, were East Germany's secret police. They enlisted ordinary people to report back about their neighbors, their friends, their family. Most people's files are absurdly mundane. You read a book, you go to a cafe, you listen to a musician. In Kutz's case, 21 people informed on him and his listening habits.
There also I read that I'm a criminal from the West propaganda and I influence the young people with the music of Frank Zappa.
Yeah, he influenced young people with the music of Frank Zappa. Now, that might sound ridiculous. Frank Zappa, an American rock musician who commissioned orchestras to play his music and who had a taste for off-color lyrics, corrupting the communist youth? Maybe. I mean, the Stasi was onto something, at least about Zappa leaving a lasting impression, because today Wulfhart Kutz runs an annual music festival that celebrates the life and work of Frank Zappa. Next week on the show, the story of how that happened.
What would the news sound like if media were diverse?
Things get racialized here. Muslim is this weird racial thing here, and I don't think our parents were prepared for that.
I'm Rupa Shenoy, host of the podcast Otherhood. Listen to What You're Missing on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Marco Werman. Time for an ice cream tour of L.A., starting with a Filipino flavor.
We call it halo halo. In English, it's mix mix.
And across town, some Persian scoops.
We have creamy rose water, ginger rose water, and then we have pomegranate sorbet.
Also, Indian ice cream with saffron, cardamom, cashews, almonds, and pistachios. The world screams for ice cream. That's ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Here's a travel tip. If you're going to Turkey, do not pack that T-shirt that says Hero. You could end up in the slammer. I'm not kidding. In the past month, Turkish police have been detaining people just for wearing a specific kind of T-shirt, plain white with the word Hero written in big block letters on the front. It's sold by a Turkish clothing brand called De Facto. Doesn't seem especially provocative. You can buy it in malls there. To find out more, we got in touch with Zia Weiss. She's a reporter based in Istanbul. So what is up with this shirt, Zia? Why has it been causing so much controversy?
So right now in Turkey, there's a series of trials going on. Soldiers who are accused of participating in the coup attempt last year are now slowly appearing for court one by one. And one such soldier appeared at court in that t-shirt, which caused an uproar because people said, how dare someone who many see as a traitor wear a t-shirt that says hero on it? And it just became this nationwide hysteria in which more than 30 people got arrested that were caught wearing the same t-shirt.
And who are they?
They're students, they're teenagers, they're unsuspecting citizens. Some of the people who've been interviewed have just said, you know, we have no idea. We're just not big followers of the news. So we just wanted to wear a nice t-shirt while going out for dinner. There have been a few children among the detained as well. I think the youngest was 13 years old. There was a 16-year-old as well.
And so that first person who was in the courtroom who was wearing the t-shirt, has he commented on why he was wearing it or what it means?
No, but we know that the t-shirt was sent to him by his sister. She hasn't made any comment as to why she sent it, but the state has now opened an investigation against the sister as well.
So what is the proof that the state has to suggest that the people who are wearing this t-shirt, the first person, the sister who sent it to him, wanted to send a message that they're heroes or something?
Well, it has very little evidence. That hasn't stopped a lot of pro-government newspapers speculating what might be behind this t-shirt. And one pro-government newspaper said that HERO was an acronym for Hoca Efendi Razı Olsun, which is a phrase that translates to "May the teacher bless you." And Hoca Efendi refers to a religious teacher, and it's a title that's often used to address Fethullah Gülen. And Gülen is an US-based cleric who the government in Turkey accuses of orchestrating the failed coup attempt.
Right, so HERO, kind of an acronym for this phrase expressing respect to a leader, Gülen. So what you're saying is the atmosphere is so fraught right now in Turkey that if a bunch of people started wearing like smiley face t-shirts, the government might find a reason to be suspicious of its meaning?
Right. I mean, it's possible. There's been so many little things like this that have somehow become linked to Gülen and his movement. The t-shirt is probably the most ridiculous that we've heard of so far. But in Turkey, very small connections to Gülen have become to be seen as evidence for support for the coup. That includes owning a $1 bill, which, you know, that's the connection to the US somehow, or having a mortgage at a bank owned by someone linked to Gülen, or attending a school, or having your daughter born in a hospital linked to Gülen.
I'm just curious. I mean, the US has gone through t-shirt fads over the years. There's the I Heart New York or fill in the blank, the keep calm and carry on meme. Has Turkey had like its own popular t-shirts over the years?
I'm struggling to think of something similar. There have been similar scandals in the past few years.
Over things on t-shirts?
Yeah. Wow. So a few years ago, pro-government media made a fuss about people wearing Giorgio Armani t-shirts because they thought this somehow referred to Armenia. And Turkey has a history of fraught relations with Armenia and has always denied that there was such a thing as an Armenian genocide. So they said this is someone supporting Armenia against Turkey.
That's interesting. I mean, maybe Istanbul just needs to understand that sometimes a t-shirt is just a piece of clothing.
That would be helpful, yes.
Zia Weiss is a reporter based in Istanbul. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
Imagine one of your sports heroes out of the blue being linked to drug trafficking. That's what many soccer fans are feeling this week in Mexico. On Wednesday, the U.S. Treasury Department identified 22 people and 43 businesses with alleged ties to a Mexican drug cartel network. Top Mexican soccer star Rafa Marquez is on that list. So is Norteño singer Julian Alvarez. The U.S. says they and the others on that list allegedly served as fronts for a money laundering operation headed by a Mexican drug kingpin. All of them have had their U.S. assets frozen. Deborah Bonello is an investigator in Mexico City for Insight Crime. That's a website that tracks organized crime in Latin America. So this sounds like a really big story in Mexico, Deborah.
It's been a huge story. I mean, the Mexicans in general have been much more interested in, you know, the sullying of Rafa. But also, I mean, according to the DEA, it's the biggest sanctioning action that's ever been taken since they've been active in Mexico. You know, 22 individual Mexicans and 42 businesses. So that's a huge effort and signals the existence of a very, very big and expansive network.
Those people and those businesses are linked, according to the U.S. Treasury Department, to this guy at the top of this drug cartel pyramid, Raul Flores Hernandez. Who is he and how big a kingpin is he?
Well, I mean, this is the incredible thing, because before these sanctions, no one had ever heard of him. You know, and when I say no one, I mean analysts. I mean, you know, a lot of people that I speak to on a regular basis. And he is not a high profile kingpin at all. He is kind of a service provider to a number of the criminal organizations working here, namely the Sinaloa cartel and the Jalisco New Generation cartel. Now, the Jalisco New Generation cartel, you may or may not have heard of, but is actually at the moment Mexico's biggest, most aggressively expanding criminal organization. You know, it's moving into a lot of the power vacuums that have been left because of the fragmentation of Sinaloa, of the Sinaloa cartel.
When you say Flores was a service provider for cartels, what does that mean?
Well, when you look at the number of businesses that they have sanctioned, that speaks to me of a pretty expansive money laundering operation, which, according to what I've been able to learn about this network, is something that the Jalisco New Generation cartel was outsourcing to him. And, you know, some of those companies were just shell companies on paper. Some of those companies were actually in operation, but all of those companies would have provided the means for them to clean up those narco proceeds and profits.
So let's get back to the soccer star, Rafa Marquez. How was he allegedly involved in all of this?
He is accused of being a prestanombres, which in English means kind of a front man or someone who agreed to take responsibility for the moving around of certain amounts of money, and that he had a relationship with Flores Hernandez from a very young age. So this is not good for either him. And I know Julian has also denied these allegations. So he's had such an amazing career. It's hard to see how this is going to have much of an impact. And sometimes, you know, the Mexican reaction to these things can be mixed, because on the one hand, there is a disdain and a contempt for organized crime and what it's done to Mexican culture. But on the other hand, there is a respect and, you know, an awe for some of the power and money that these people have generated. So whether it will kind of embellish or tarnish his public profile is yet to be seen.
Well, and also soccer has a huge status in Mexico, so I'm just wondering if it's sullied at all his reputation.
Well, I mean, it's, you know, it's very early days. I mean, it's certainly been leading the news reports over the last few days, and that's for sure. You know, organized crime, as you know, has had a long relationship with sports. You know, we saw Pablo Escobar and his football interest. You know, that's something that's definitely become tradition, as has its relationship to other sports like boxing. So it's no surprise in a way, but I mean, this really is kind of the David Beckham, or I don't know what the US equivalent would be, but he is one of the highest profile players that Mexico has.
Deborah Bonello with Insight Crime in Mexico City. Thanks very much.
Good speaking to you, Marco.
Okay, take a guess now at how many scoops of ice cream the average American eats every year. Less than 100 or more? Well, it's actually less, but not much less. 92 scoops every year. Most of that is vanilla or chocolate, but there are a lot more flavors out there, as you'll find when Valerie Hamilton takes us on this global ice cream tour of Los Angeles.
If you're like me, you sometimes have trouble choosing what kind of ice cream to get. I mean, there's coffee, obviously, but what about raspberry? With sprinkles, but I mean, Oreos. So you'll be glad to know the Philippines have got you covered.
We call it halo-halo, or in English it's mix-mix.
I'm at Lee Lin's Filipino Bakery, where Rachel Ozeta is introducing me to Halo Halo. In the Philippines, where she's originally from, mixing it up is a national tradition. You start with shaved ice and evaporated milk. Then you go nuts.
We have the flan, we have the langka or jackfruit, we have the mixed beans, jello, nata de coco, and the Rice Krispies.
Rice Krispies?
Yes, yes.
It's the everything bagel philosophy applied to dessert, and its crowning glory is a scoop of the most amazing ice cream you have ever seen, ube.
It's a yam. It's a purple yam.
When Ozeta says it's purple, like Prince purple. It's also sweet, kind of nutty, and really delicious. In the Philippines, it's a staple. Here in L.A., it's helped make Halo Halo a neighborhood hit.
Thank you so much. Latinos, Indians, Koreans, yeah, they love our Halo Halo too.
Immigrants and ice cream go way back. A French chef was churning it out in New York in 1774. At Ellis Island in the 20s, new arrivals ate ice cream sandwiches, and at the 1904 World's Fair, it was an immigrant from Syria who rolled up a waffle to make one of the first ice cream cones.
So we're in our kitchen, and we are standing by a pot of milk and cream.
At an ice cream shop in L.A.'s Little India, Smita Vasant is showing me how to make kulfi, traditional Indian ice cream. It's like a creamy, spicy caramel popsicle without the stick. The recipe's simple. Heat and stir. And stir. It's hard to find in the U.S. because not many people make it.
It's a long, laborious process. And then maybe nobody loves ice cream as much as I do.
Vasant grew up in Mumbai, eating ice creams with saffron, fennel seed, the flavors of India. The ice cream here just wasn't the same.
We love vanilla chocolate. All of this ice cream here is delicious, but you still have that memory of what you ate back home.
So she started making her own, like Rajbhog, made with saffron, cardamom, cashews, almonds, and pistachios.
All these things coming together, oh my God, it's heaven. Really good.
Well, I have to fact check that. And just to be sure, I also tasted her mango, guava, rose. Yeah. Indian ice cream dates to the 16th century, but the ancient Persians were eating frozen desserts way back in 400 BC. They'd store snow in the winter, then serve it up in the summer with fruit syrup on top.
The syrup we call sherbet, I think that's where sherbet comes from.
Mehdi Shirvani has a Persian ice cream shop in Hollywood. His uncle made ice cream back in Iran, and those recipes live on here.
We have creamy rose water, we have ginger rose water, and then we have pomegranate sorbet.
Shirvani is going to make me one of his famous ice cream sandwiches.
I'm putting a scoop of saffron.
Saffron rose water ice cream mashed between two wafers, like back in Iran.
By the way, I eat this almost every day.
I take a bite.
Wow.
I could eat another one. But there's so much to try. Mexican paletas, Korean pingsu. Before I overdo it, I decide to consult an expert. Adrian Borlongan owns Wanderlust Creamery in L.A.'s San Fernando Valley. She makes everything from Icelandic rye bread ice cream to a Japanese-style Neapolitan. For her, it's more than a business. It's a mission.
I wanted to globalize people's palates, and I thought what better way to do that with ice cream, because everyone loves ice cream.
See, Borlongan is from L.A., but her parents are from the Philippines, and she grew up eating that bright purple Filipino yam, ube.
You know, when I was growing up and my birthday cake was purple, an ube cake, kids from my class would be like, what's that? Ew, I don't want to try it.
But thanks to the likes of Halo Halo, kulfi, and Persian ice cream sandwiches, she says palates are changing.
It makes me happy when I see a little kid and they're eating a purple ice cream, knowing that they're going to grow up and they're going to know what ube is.
Because ube wouldn't be the first imported tropical flavor to go mainstream. Check your freezer. Got chocolate and vanilla? You can thank Mexico and Guatemala for those. For The World, Valerie Hamilton, Los Angeles.
I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Considering those 1960s Westerns with Clint Eastwood and other tough guys were quintessential Hollywood fare, it's odd that they're called spaghetti Westerns, even odder that the actual film location was Spain. Perhaps the greatest movie of that period, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, was filmed in northern Spain. Going there is a pilgrimage for many film buffs. And now local volunteers are working to restore the location of one of the movie's best-known scenes. My BBC colleague Guy Hedgeco has that story.
It's an unforgettable scene. In a secluded cemetery, Clint Eastwood meets Lee Van Cleef and Eli Wallach for a duel that will settle who keeps the gold buried in one of the graves. It's the climactic moment of The Good, the Bad and the Ugly, Sergio Leone's 1966 classic, soundtracked by Ennio Morricone. For Spanish filmmaker Guillermo de Oliveira, it's a great cinematic moment.
They are just one of the most wonderful 20 minutes in film history you can think of. Every nuance of the film is explored. Once each of the characters is placed in their position, they stare at each other for 3.5 minutes, and all you get is this tension, this very close-up looks of their eyes, and at the same time juxtaposed with the long shots of the cemetery. And you build up this tension, obviously, with the help of Morricone's music.
Oliveira is such a fan of the movie that he's made a documentary about the place where that final scene was filmed and how it has been restored to its former glory by a group of local enthusiasts. The site is in an isolated spot near the city of Burgos, and it has kept its English name, Sad Hill, from the original movie. The documentary is called Sad Hill Unearthed. In the town of Salas de los Infantes, members of the Sad Hill Cultural Association meet. These are volunteers who've been working on the cemetery since 2015, painstakingly excavating the site and uncovering paving stones that were buried under grass. They've also put up hundreds of wooden crosses to replicate the tombs of the original movie. It's a project which has united people, young and old. Domingo Contreras is a local priest. As a 20-year-old, he was hired as a harmonica playing extra in The Good, the Bad and the Ugly.
This restoration project deserves a gold medal. Anything which motivates people to get out of the house and learn new things is good. Maybe you don't even like movies, but if you have the soul of a poet or an artist, this place will stir something in you.
I'm standing in the middle of Sad Hill Cemetery on a boiling summer's afternoon, and it looks exactly like it did in The Good, the Bad and the Ugly. All around me are wooden crosses put up by the volunteers who have restored the site, and there's even the famous grave from the film marked Unknown, where the gold is buried. A volunteer has just arrived at the cemetery, and he's doing some work on a couple of the crosses. I'm going to go and talk to him.
Hi, my name is Sergio García. I'm one of the volunteers of Association Sad Hill. We are talking about one of the most brilliant sequences of the whole story of the cinema. And it was empty. It was empty of life, and we thought that we must rebuild.
Yep, they must. Rebuilding an iconic location from The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. That was volunteer Sergio García ending that report by my BBC colleague, Guy Hedgeco. We heard earlier from our Across Women's Lives team in South Africa. They've been focusing all week on the HIV epidemic there and its impact on young women in particular. And in the course of their reporting, our team met several women who are tackling another big problem, gender-based violence, and the tensions between men and women around that issue. That's a big part of what fuels the work of South African visual artist Lady Scully. She draws and paints in a style that looks like brightly colored cave drawings. Lady Scully talked to our team in South Africa about her art, about what it means to be called colored, and what it feels like to be a woman walking the streets of Johannesburg.
Okay, yeah, so what I do is, I love those techniques from when we were children and they were teaching us stuff. Like, remember when you would cover a whole sheet with wax and then you paint over it with paint and then you scratch through and then it makes these crazy... That's still something I want to experiment with. Spinning in this roller coaster called life. I know in the rest of the world the term colored is derogatory or it relates to a negative history. Here it has a similar history. The word coloured, except here we still use it in South Africa. There's like lots of different types of coloureds in South Africa, but I think the main group is they are family of the Khoisan, which is like they were bushmen. They were like the first inhabitants of Southern Africa, of Africa, of the world, actually. And in this work, which we can go over to, this work is, I mean, fire, ritual, Khoisan. They're just like, the Khoisan have this amazing thing of trance. So like, you know, that trance-like state when you, and chanting and all of that type of thing around a fire. So for me, this image is, it's got like a burning vagina in the middle of the shot. So it's almost like, and they're all men. So it's like they're warming themselves around a burning vagina, which to me is pretty much South Africa. All the men having a fun time while we flaming up. The sky may fall before I get to where I want to be. And then just to kind of like isolate the vibe, I like surround the Bushman figure, the Khoisan figure, with wax. Like, we can't walk anywhere. Like, in Joburg, as a woman, if you're walking somewhere and you get raped, people will be like, babe, no offense, but it was your fault. Like, you know you shouldn't be walking. And that's the thing, it's so easy. It's just, everything we do is monitored and like, controlled by our fear of men here. We can't see what's wrong, otherwise it would be too much for us to absorb. If we actually acknowledged what apartheid and what everything did to us in terms of sexual relations and gender dynamics and tensions between each other, it would be too much, I think. I feel so trapped in these four walls that I live in. I'm not a nihilist, but I don't even know if we'll ever get where we're supposed to be going. To me, sometimes it feels like this whole struggle of being a woman is the point of being a woman. The sky may fall
before I get to where I wanna be. South African artist Lady Skali ending our show today. The music you're hearing is by South African singer-songwriter Amanda Black. A big thanks to our Across Women's Lives team for all their reporting this week. The world's theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH. I'm Marco Werman. Have a great weekend.
PRI, Public Radio International.